The topic that I'll just address briefly this afternoon is Aquinas on our political life. Really just to ponder for a moment, not really what is politics. We all have enough experience of that to be able to answer that question. But why do we have politics? I mean, what's the origin of our political life? You know, why is it that we are seemingly thrust into the public square and are forced to have political opinions and to work for political objectives? What's this for? And why do we have it? Most of modernity, you know, treats our political life as a kind of necessary evil. You know, that politics somehow has its origin in sin. You know, that we gather and we work together politically to overcome some kind of evil, whether that's selfishness or things like that. And that somehow, if we didn't have politics, or if we didn't have this evil to overcome that politics is supposed to vanquish, then we'd somehow live happier lives. And a lot of our political theories that drive our political thinking and even our political living today are based on this. Aquinas, though, in the Thomist tradition, I would say more widely, the Christian tradition has a different view. And that's what I'd like to share with you this afternoon. In fact, St. Thomas's understanding of the origin of politics helps us to answer kind of the riddle that's raised in today's gospel. You know, the scribes and Pharisees, out of malice, because they want to entrap him, ask a pretty difficult question. They ask Jesus to answer this: whether or not the Jewish people were obliged to pay the Roman tax. And this was a question, I mean, fraught with danger. Whether Christ said yes or whether he said no, he was going to get in trouble with somebody. And that's why the question was posed to him. If he said yes, that the Jewish people were obliged to pay the Roman tax, he would have upset, obviously, the Jewish religious authorities, you know, for whom the Romans were an occupying force, an invading force, and were keeping the Jewish people subjected to unjust rule. And to support them with a tax was just unthinkable, or at least traitors. So if Christ would have said yes, this would have been a problem. Had he said no, well, then he would have had trouble with the Roman authorities, you know, for planting seeds of sedition and revolution, disobedience, that this subjugated people was not to pay the tax for various reasons. And of course, we all know Christ's famous answer. He avoids the question by stating just a simple truth, what cuts through the heart of the matter, or through to the heart of the matter. But you just said, everyone, every human being is obliged to pay to Caesar what belongs to Caesar, and to God what belongs to God. Now, on the surface, that might solve Christ's immediate predicament. You know, he escapes the trap of the scribes and the Pharisees. But for the Christian, our work just starts then, because we have to come to a deeper understanding of what it is that Christ means by that answer. And one of the questions we have to ask is, who is Caesar, to whom we owe something that's due to him? And I think for Aquinas, the deeper question was not who is Caesar, but what is Caesar? What is this thing that Caesar represents? Which is to say, our political life and our political cooperation. What is this thing that is political authority that exercises some control over our lives, to whom, Christ says, we owe something? Injustice. Now, when St. Thomas treats this question, he's a bit like Jesus. I mean, he wants to avoid all of the complicating factors that get into discussing our political life. You know, he doesn't want to get into questions of conservatives, liberals, right, left, you know, who's in charge, you know, the upper class, lower class. He wants to ask the question of our political life together that avoids, you know, all of these complicating factors, often complicated, you know, by sin, in fact. And so he asks the question, would there have been a political life or even political authority in paradise, in the garden, before the fall? What would politics have looked like? Now, again, I think modernity answers that question in a certain way, which is just to say it wouldn't have existed. Because if the presupposition is that politics is an effect of the fall, well, then before the fall, before sin, there wouldn't have been any need for it, for a coercive authority to organize our common life together. That's not St. Thomas's view. He says, of course, there would have been, even before the fall, politics and governments and political authority. Now, why does he say that? And that's what I think is interesting, and that's what I want to talk about a little bit this morning. Aquinas says that if you really understand what it is to have a common good, say something like the common good of the family or the common good of the city, that just naturally out of that reality and naturally out of the common work to pursue that good, something like authority would emerge. And that's what would have existed in paradise. For example, just take a family. You know, you want to take a family vacation. You know, it's the summertime and you want to do something together to get away from work, school, and the neighborhood, do something different. The fact of the matter is that husband, wife, children can't all just decide for themselves what they're going to do for vacation. Dad can't say, I'm going to Vegas. Mom can't say, you know, I'm going to Savannah. Kids can't say, I'm going to Disney World. And then everybody do that and just think that that's a family vacation. No, to enjoy the good of a vacation together requires that the family stay together, first of all, but that you also do the same things together. You travel together. You stay together. You visit the same things together. You eat together. You enjoy these experiences and these goods together. And in fact, that's what constitutes a family vacation. You can't speak of a family vacation apart from that. Now, you can have some deliberation among the family members about this. Okay, where are we going to go? What are we going to do? And come to some consensus. But even in the best of circumstances, someone has to stand up at the end of the day and say, this is what we're doing. A decision by one has to be made for the whole, for there to actually be some kind of common experience there, to enjoy Vegas together, or to enjoy Savannah together, to enjoy Disney World together. This need for authority and this need for someone, at least, to take charge for the whole, for Aquinas, is not the result of sin. It's not the result of trying to protect the group from some evil. It's just of the very nature of what it takes for people to come together and to work together for a common good. It works at the city level, too. You know, not just in family, but as a city. You know, someone, in organizing the life of the political community, has to exercise some kind of authority to make decisions for the whole. I mean, traffic, you know, is a typical example that we as citizens or as you know, say residents of McLean, can't all just decide for ourselves how we're going to use the roads, what the signs mean, what the colors of the stoplight mean, and all of that. If we did, there would be complete chaos. Now, we can come together and discuss those things, but at the end of the day, a decision has to be made by someone who possesses the authority to do so, to say, red means stop, green means go, big red sign means don't go through the intersection without coming to a complete stop. You drive on the right side of the road, not the left. And that there's a cooperation, everybody doing the same thing because it's decided by one or by the authority. And therefore we can achieve many good things because we all follow the same traffic pattern. And that's just a simple example. When it comes to markets, when it comes to educational systems, when it comes to transportation systems, things like that, I mean, the decisions become very complex. But it all follows the same principle. That in order to achieve a good, that requires people to come together, to cooperate in order to enjoy that good, naturally there has to be someone who stands in the center of the activity and organizes and coordinates the activity for the whole. Expanding his understanding of this, St. Thomas recognizes then that there's different kinds of virtues then that are needed in political life. That the kind of prudence that's required for, let's say, the life of a family or our political life to flourish, different kinds of prudence need to be exercised. The prudence of the leader he called regnative prudence, which is a kind of executive prudence. It's the prudence of the one who's in charge. Because he sees, or she sees, the good of the whole and understands the end to which everyone has to work together, then the leader's in the privileged position to make those kinds of decisions for the whole, to promulgate law, to issue directives, and even to make executive decisions on the fly, again, which are for the good of the whole. And the leader does that well, virtuously, through this kind of prudence. Regnative prudence. But there's also what Aquinas says is political prudence, generally speaking. And this is the prudence of the citizens, who also have to exercise their own decision-making in cooperating with the whole, but he says that's just it. It's a prudence kind of obedience to the law, and virtuously following what's set out by the authority in order to be able to cooperate with everyone else in order to achieve the final and the common good. And that too is a virtuous activity. That we all don't all have to be our own boss. We all don't have to all be our own president in order to attain and achieve the good of our political community, be it the city, the state, or the country. That there's a certain prudence, a certain virtue that's exercised in obedience, in following the law. Now, for Aquinas, that's not done mindlessly, because each citizen still has an intellect, and in fact, should use his or her intellect to evaluate the justice of the good. And that's why we have political debate, and that's why we have, you know, political parties, you know, because we come together around common solutions to common questions, that we agree with others and we work to attain certain ends and to organize our political life in a certain way. Well, that's because we remain political beings, intelligent beings, who are to engage wisely and intelligently in our political life. To engage intelligently, you know, even our obedience to the law. So that's a fascinating thing, I think, that Aquinas sees, that our political life together is something very natural to us, and that it arises everywhere where two, in a sense, two or three gather and establish, you know, a common goal for themselves. That authority has to be exercised. Someone has to make decisions for the whole. And that it's good for the others to follow those decisions in obedience. in cooperation. And for Aquinas, this isn't an answer to sin. It doesn't even arise from sin, but simply because of the way that God made us. As knowers and lovers who have goods in life that can only be achieved when we come together and work together. This is seen most clearly in the family, but it's the same principle at work in our political life. There's no question that we live in very interesting political times. And it can often seem that much of what we do in our politics, at least from, let's say, the Christian point of view, is in opposition to sin or to mitigate the effects of sin. And there's no question about that. It is. But that can be very discouraging, you know, if we enter into political life thinking that's, in fact, or that's all it's for. But I think Aquinas encourages us by having a better and deeper view, a wise view of what our political life is for, that it is for the common good, the good for which we've been made to pursue, the good that does perfect us, and that despite the circumstances of our political moment, it's still a good and virtuous thing to do. Now, there's a popular conversation that's circulating right now as to what is the place of the Christian in our political life, or in our current political circumstances. What's the prudent thing to do? Detach, and at least maybe retreat a bit to recharge our batteries in order to go back in at a later moment? Or is it to engage in a good that is in fact ours to enjoy, and that regardless of our own political, our own religious faith, that the common good, the political square, belongs just as much to us as to anyone else. And therefore it is perfective of us. It is something that leads to our happiness, you know, to be engaged with our contemporaries in the political debates, conversations, and struggles of the day. I'm convinced that Aquinas would encourage us in that direction, simply because of the way he understands the origin of our political life. It's not something we can opt out of, even temporarily. But the political good is our good. And God has made us to pursue it. Today, besides being the 29th Sunday in Ordinary Time, it's also the feast of St. Pope John Paul II. And I think it's rather fortuitous that we gather for this conversation on his feast day, because if he, I think more than anyone else, perhaps, in our own day, models, exemplifies this understanding of our political life and of the Christian's place in it. If you just think back on just what he experienced as a young Pole, you know, living through, being born in 1920, so, you know, his earliest years are living in Poland, devastated by the First World War. You know, he's a late adolescent, a young man, when the Second World War starts, and Poland again is ripped apart, you know, through invasion and domination, first by the Nazis and then by the Soviets. I mean, for him, as a believing Christian, as a priest, and then as a bishop, I mean, his faith was certainly not an excuse to withdraw, but to engage, first as a human being, but also as a human being enlightened by the gospel. And through his long life of fidelity to the gospel, saw each of the regimes that dominated his homeland fall. And I can only imagine that brought him deep satisfaction, even if very late in life saw, you know, the struggles that political freedom, you know, brings to a people, as he certainly saw in Poland. But even in his final days, you know, remained engaged in providing strategy is not the right word, but wisdom, discovering and articulating those wise principles that can organize our political life in leading to its flourishing in the light of the gospel. And so having this conversation this afternoon, reflecting on these truths and these realities, we certainly ask for his intercession today, the intercession of Pope John, St. Pope John Paul II, in helping us to engage the questions of our own time with the same light, the same truth, the same courage with which he engaged the difficulties of his day.
Thank you very much, Father. Please help me thank you.